Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. Gary Trust here, Billboard's co-director of charts.
And hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
So we told you about this last week. We're doing something different this week. Normally every week we look at the current Billboard Hot 100, Top 10, talk about all that. But due to some vacation time, Trevor, I suppose being in England as this is
not that Gary's going to air my business. Oh, like, I'll just be away, but yes, if you happen to be in England and an avid listener of the Chartbeat Podcast, please find me. And
Trevor's
and
world tour.
Let me know. Yeah, truly. We'll see how many stamps we come back with.
So because of that, getting ahead, so we're taping these ahead of time, but flashing back to the Billboard Hot 100 this week in 1997, and then next week we'll go back to 2007, so 20 years and 10 years ago, looking at the top 40 songs on the Hot 100, 20 and 10 years ago. All right, so 20 years back, 1997. We're also going to chat with one of the artists on the chart that week. A huge hit that year. Paula Cole broke through with Where Have All the Cowboys Gone? We're going to talk to her.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the number one song this week, 20 years ago. Fairly historic one, too. And it incorporated some elements that we still see in hits today. So we'll count down from number 40 to number one, the Billboard Hot 100, this week, 20 years ago. All right, numbers 40 to 36 on the Hot 100 this week. 20 years ago, I started with Trisha Yearwood, How Do I Live? We're going to hear another version of that song coming up in the countdown. Number 39, Blessed Union of Souls, I Want to Be There. Number 38, Joe, Don't Want to Be a Player. Did I say that right? Was it player or was it player?
Well, how's it spelled, Gary?
It's spelled player, E-R.
So there you go.
Smoking Me Out, number 37, Warren G, featuring Ronald Isley.
Yeah, you know, the Isley Brothers in particular, big, big, big sample base in hip-hop. I mean, I think there are a few studies out there that say they may be along with James Brown, like the most sampled act. I mean, there's so many songs, I mean, even R&B songs in particular, that I think people don't even know that they're based off Isley Brothers songs.
Yeah, and Ronald Isley had a few hits around that time, 96, 97, with R. Kelly, Keith Sweat, as well as Warren G. So this is actually just one of those songs.
Yeah.
And number 36, two hits in one for Tony Braxton, I Don't Want To, and the B-side, because at the time, singles could chart as A and B-sides. When
physical
singles. Yeah, we're going back singles. To physical singles at this point. I Don't Want To was the A-side, and I Love Me Some Him was the B-side. They charted together. Got to number 19, was down to number 36 this week.
Sound like those just sound like Tony Braxton songs. Like I Love Me Some Him, that just sounds very 90s Tony Braxton.
And she had so many hits that this one's maybe a little obscure, given how many hits she had in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, this would have been the Secrets album, so this is in the same vein as You're Making Me High from Waiting to Exhale. It's called Let It Flow. That's also at the same time. And of course, Unbreak My Heart, you know, at the end of 96, obviously being a humongous ballad. So, in that same era.
All right, talking about huge R&B pop ballads, here's one at number 35.
There's nothing to
Little Kim, Little Kim, bring it to me now.
I know a dude named Ron Dude, push a cue. Had a wild crew on Flatbush and Avenue U. Had a weed spot, used to pump African black. He used to seal his bag, so his workers wouldn't tap.
We just heard a sample of I Believe I Can Fly, Robert Kelly bringing it home from the Space Jam soundtrack. If you were a kid at this time, trust me, and I guess even
older
for
people,
the adults,
like me, yep.
The Gen Xers like Gary at the time, of course, Michael Jordan, you know, the biggest thing, probably biggest celebrity probably in, right, you know, pop culture at the moment.
Yeah, we're actually talking 97. That was still in the middle of the second run of three titles for the Bulls.
Yeah. MJ had come back from his little baseball stint. Obviously had time to do a movie as well, and the soundtrack, huge for R. Kelly. Always kind of weird personal kind of anecdote. They used to sing this song in church a lot, and it's so weird because I think for a lot of kids, that was their first introduction to R. Kelly. And so when you look at, like, R. Kelly's back catalog and, like, all the things that he'd already done at the time, and, I mean, you got, like, obviously Bump and Grind, and Your Body's Calling, and it's like, oh, this is not, like, what I expected Robert Kelly's, you know, whole body of work to be like. Trying to find a way to get R. Kelly in church, make it up, spice it up a little bit.
Perfect song, though, for that set.
Yeah, I mean, obviously very uplifting, very, you know, inspirational. So, good for Robert. All right, coming in at number 34, right above R. Kelly, we got Your Woman by Whitetown.
Yeah, there were so many sort of one-hit wonder type alternative acts in the late 90s. We'll hear from at least one more coming up. But a really quirky song, really. Just a lot of different sounds, kind of dancey, kind of pop. Just really what alternative was at the time.
All right, number 33. We actually got a debut this week. So the song debuted at number 33, Not Tonight from Nothing to Lose. So we got another soundtrack going on as well. The all-woman hip-hop collective of Lil' Kim, Da Brat, Left Eye, Missy Elliott, and Angie Martinez. So long before Khaled got the crew together on I'm the One, the ladies were holding it down.
Oh, I like the one at number 32 we heard.
Yeah, 1997. I mean, this is 20 years basically after Saturday Night Fever. And you thought that the Bee Gees in there, white jumpsuits died with the movement, but
they weren't wearing the white jumpsuits at that point.
probably better for their sake than anyone else's.
Yeah, and the song was certainly – it wasn't a disco song at all. It was a much more of an updated sound. Turned out to be their last top 40 Hot 100 hit 20 years ago this week, but also 50 years ago now, 1967, that they had their first top 40 hit. So at the time, they were celebrating 30 years. Great song. Really good pop song.
I mean, the Bee Gees were chock full of them. I mean, obviously their own stuff. They wrote, you know, Islands in the Stream and some other songs.
Right.
Pop hit makers all around. All right, moving up to number 31, we heard See You When You Get There from, once again, Nothing to Lose. So Nothing to Lose was the soundtrack of the week, apparently.
Right.
That's it's almost like the most like 90s thing you can say. It's Coolio featuring 40 Thieves. So Coolio actually by this point had already had Gangsta's Paradise as a huge song. So not too far removed from that, just about almost 2 years. But Coolio, again, making the move. Fun fact, it was also the greatest gainer in sales that week. So kids were going out to their local Best Buys in Circuit City and, you know, snatching up that Coolio single. Can you say anything more 90s than that? I'm just asking. You lied to me. Said you never would play me. But I found out that you were lying out of time.
Time prayer, sticking little white flowers all up in her hair. Walk beside the pony, Daddy. It's my first ride.
Biggie, 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 can't you see? Sometimes your words just hypnotize me, and I just love your flashy ways. I guess that's why they're broken. You're so mean. Biggie, 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 can't you see? Sometimes your words just hypnotize me.
Moving on the Hot 100. This week, we're flashing back 20 years. The top 40 hits on the Billboard Hot 100 this week, July 12th, 1997. That chart was dated. Number 30, Casey and JoJo with You Bring Me Up. That was before All My Life would be the next year. It'd be a huge number one hit for them.
Yeah, you know, people have gotten to know them a little bit, obviously, through their work with Jodeci at the time. But yeah, they start to break out.
Interesting song at number 29. It's Butterfly Kisses by the Raybon Brothers. The main hit version was by Bob Carlyle. But it wasn't available as a commercial single, so it was only an airplay hit. It couldn't chart on the Hot 100 rules at the time. You had to be a single you could buy in stores. So that wasn't. So that didn't chart. So there's a country cover because the song was so big. So that came out as a commercial single, hit the top 40. Number 28, former number one hit.
Biggie, of course, you know, gunned down earlier that year. So really, you know, the tribute's starting to pour out. Everybody, of course, it really is the summer that Bad Boy Records in general just kind of ruled these charts. Obviously, one of Big's best songs, you know? I mean, still to this day, you can hear it just, I mean, anywhere, every playlist, whether it's, I mean, back even school dance, you can just hear it on the bus, people just, you know, rudely blaring it on the subway or whatever, but you can't get too mad because it's a good song. So, yeah, Big making his first mention on these charts won't be his last.
All right, number 27, we heard another version of the song back at number 40. It was also number 27 by Leanne Rimes. So I think a lot of people know the story that there were dueling How Do I Lives on the chart in 1997, one by Trisha Yearwood, one by Leanne Rimes. And Trisha Yearwood's was the version that made it into the movie Con Air. Leanne Rimes, she was not yet 15 at the time. So a lot of thinking was that she was too young to sing a song like this. So it didn't make it into the movie. But her version still came out as a single, and even though it didn't make the movie, it wound up being the much bigger hit on the Hot 100. Trisha Yearwood's version would get to number 23, Leanne Rimes would get to number 2, and how's this for ultimately winning? It's the most successful song ever by a woman on the Hot 100. When we recap the greatest of all time, last time it was number 4 overall, top charting song ever by a female artist. How Do I Live, Leanne Rimes.
They're saying also that potentially Leanne's version wasn't quite country enough, a little too poppy, some people are saying. Also, very weird how at the Grammy Awards the next year, Leanne Rimes sings the song immediately before they give out the Grammy for Country Vocal Performance. They're both nominated.
Right.
And Trisha Yearwood wins.
And number 26, All For You, is actually a debut from Sister Hazel, a Florida band. You know that song, at the time, Hootie and the Blowfish had been so big for a couple of years, and you started to see other songs come out that had that same kind of, you know, southern rock pop feel to them. And this song wound up being a huge hit, but I think in some ways it kind of owed a little bit to the influence of Hootie, who had been so big at that point. And Janet Jackson would not remake it 4 years later. Her All For You, totally different song.
A Janet Jackson, I guess you could really say it's a Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis original.
Now it's on the hot track, melt like it's hot wax. Put it out, all the stores, bet you can shop that.
I have often dreamed of a far off place where a hero's welcome would be waiting for.
This goes out to all the women in the world, especially her. You know it don't even matter your age. Don't even matter your color, your fellas, I ain't forget about y'all. This is for everybody to like my game. Just listen to what I'm saying and do it and take a chance. I put my hand up on your hip. When I dip, you dip, we dip. You put your hand up on my hip. When you dip, I dip, we dip. I put my hand up on your hip. When I dip, you dip, we dip. You put yours and then I put mine. Then we can dip down low and roll and grind. Get on the floor like
you go have a beer.
All right, keep it on climbing here on the Hot 100, looking back at 1997. This week, we are up to 25. It is another Bad Boy record smash. Puff Daddy's Can't Nobody Hold Me Down, featuring Mace. The song had been number one already earlier that year. Again, I mean, this is the season of the Bad Boy takeover. Sliding down a little bit. I mean, this, you know, it had been number 20 last week, dropping 25. But again, I mean, and really, you know, importantly, one of Puff Daddy's first hits on his own. He'd obviously been producing for, you know, Notorious B.I.G., for Lil' Kim, for Mary J. Blige even. But he steps out with a No Way Out album and his own song and gets to number one.
Just like how 1997 appropriate we're being by calling him Puff Daddy. That's what he was billed as on the chart at the time.
That's who he was. Sean Combs had only one nickname at the time instead of the 16 he apparently goes by now.
And the song reworks Break My Stride by Matthew Wilder, and not the only song in the top 40 this week in 1997 by then named Puff Daddy that reworked a big 80s hit.
Number 24 this week, also a very 90s kind of trend. The song is Go the Distance from the film Hercules as performed by Michael Bolton. I mean, again, another 90s sort of takeover is the Disney Renaissance that we saw really starting with Little Mermaid back in the 80s, but through Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King, Pocahontas. Now we're at Hercules. Michael Bolton is taking on the song, turning it into another top 40 hit. I mean, like we saw all those films. I mean, we saw with Beauty and the Beast, we saw Celine and Peebo take it to the top 10. A Whole New World, Peebo Bryson, and Regina Bell got a number one out of that. With Lion King, Elton John, you know, taking some of those songs from the soundtrack and reworking them for the pop radio version. Vanessa Williams is on Pocahontas doing Colors of the Wind. Now it's Michael Bolton's turn. 2 years later, Phil Collins will also show up when he does the Tarzan soundtrack. So such a trademark of the 90s to have these huge artists take these songs from these musicals, basically win the Oscar every year as well. So
you're going to give all the love to Disney, though, and not Michael Bolton? That was all Disney. There was nothing Michael Bolton about that.
Well, but it was the Disney machine that made it work, you know? I mean, that's, you got to go, that's the problem is Michael Bolton, of course, gets the credit, but Alan Menken, Tim Rice, all those guys who are down there in the trenches doing the work that nobody shouts out.
Well, you
that's who needs the right. love.
But you didn't grow up with Michael Bolton being on radio throughout the early part of the 90s. So this was actually his last Hot 100 hit of the 90s. He had so many hits before then. He's had one more since in 2011. He was featured on The Lonely Islands. Jack Sparrow. It's the only other time he's been back on the chart.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Wow.
Kind of parodying his sound.
Yo, that dramatic vocal is top notch, truly. Number 23, which is The Dip by Freak Nasty. Guys, we're going to have to do a video series soon where we teach Gary to dip. So if you want to check that out, please look forward. In the meantime, we'll give Gary a break because he did a lot of heavy lifting on this next one, number 22 this week on the Hot 100 1997. Where Have All the Cowboys Gone? Paula Cole, who is going to be our special insider interview this week on the Chartbeat podcast. Paula to talk about, obviously, the song making its way up the chart that year. And really, one of those interesting kind of eras. Obviously, talking about Bad Boy taking over and all that kind of thing. But the singer-songwriter was a huge presence in 97.
So, yeah, Paula Cole, number 22. Male song in that same vein, though, of at least the adult pop at the time. Duncan Sheik, number 21, Barely Breathing.
Yeah, who also will go on in the next decade to be a huge contributor to Spring Awakening on Broadway.
Right. But Paula Cole, she's our guest as our industry insider interview. And we're going to bring in our intern as well here in the charts department, Kristen Corpus.
Making her Billboard Sharpie podcast debut.
Because right. Kristen knows Paula pretty well, having taken a class with her at Berklee College of Music in Boston. So Paula, after having these hits in the 90s, she's gone on to still do music. She has a new album coming out. We'll talk about that. But she loves teaching younger musicians coming up at Berklee. And she's from Rockport, Massachusetts. So Berklee's in Boston nearby. So we'll get into all that and we'll find out the story behind Where Have All the Cowboys Gone, her other huge hit, the Dawson's Creek theme, maybe how people know it now. I Don't Want to Wait. So Paula Cole, our guest here on the Billboard Sharpie podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Paula Cole, thank you so much for joining us on the Billboard Sharpie podcast.
Hi, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Trevor's here. I'm here. And Kristen Corpus, Billboard intern extraordinaire, is here as well. And Kristen, really interesting tie-in here. You took a class with Paula Cole at Berklee in Boston.
I did. She teaches vocal perspectives on songwriting. So technically, it's a class within the vocal department, but it's sort of, she calls it writing out your life. And she gives us prompts. She gave us prompts every week that we had to respond to, write a song every week. It was extremely challenging just because she wanted full-blown, completely finished, polished songs every week that we had to perform in front of the class. And it was a very interesting learning experience for me, I think, because she gave us the prompts that were very challenging.
Mm. So you're a tough professor, Paula, it sounds like.
It it's like parenting. I'm firm, but I'm loving.
Okay, so just vocal perspectives on song. So that's like obviously writing from a vocalist point of view. Or?
Yeah, I think she. Well, Paula can correct me if I'm wrong, but I the way I interpreted the class was sort of you take people who are singers primarily, and sort of she forced us to self accompany. Not forced, but she encouraged us to self accompany and to write from a very honest place. I think her frame of mind for the class was to make sure that people who are singers are not just singers, that they're able to tell their stories in an honest, authentic way. And she gave us prompts that challenged the way we thought, that, you know, we had to explore various parts of our identity in order to create songs that felt real. And there were a lot of people in the class who had never written songs before. And then there were also people who were very seasoned songwriters. So I think it was just sort of feeding off of the energy of the people in the room and sort of finding a way to be honest with people that you probably didn't know. And then also creating stuff that you could use not just for the class, but for your repertoire as well, for your own original performances.
Do you like teaching, Paul? It's a whole different side of artistry and not just writing for yourself.
It's a very different thing. Yeah. But basically, the way I see it is I'm hopefully coming into contact with these millennials and inspiring them to become artists. Some of them may not take that path, but I feel like that's why I'm there, and I'll shine my light, and hopefully they'll shine their light, and they can learn from me that being an artist is a big life choice, and it encompasses many skill sets. A lot of it is emotional intelligence, like interpersonal and intrapersonal intelligence, knowing thyself and being able to communicate with others. But it's also entrepreneurship. It's being a good hang in the van. It's having the courage to be an honest autobiographical writer. It's knowing some production and being literate, like looking for inspiration beyond the frequent junk food that is top 40, right? And looking for inspiration, like David Bowie used to read Russian authors in the tube, even when he admittedly didn't understand them as a young man, but he was searching for meaning, searching for self-expansion, and it all comes into the artistry. So being an artist, that's what I'm hoping to help him find. And It's a good gig at Berkeley because they let me be free when I need to be free, and I can be involved with the younger generation. It's made me a better musician, too.
How'd that come about, Paul? I think you've been there, what, since 2013, right?
Yes. Well, they had offered me a job before, but it just the timing wasn't right. I went to Berkeley. I went as a jazz singer and emerged from there, realizing that I wasn't going to be a jazz singer, even though I had been offered a record deal from a jazz label while I was still at Berkeley, because I didn't want to sing the realities written by Rodgers and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein anymore. I wanted to sing my own realities. And there was some kind of healing and discovery in that. So I started on my path of writing my own songs. And they've been this funky blend of many influences for many years, and I don't feel understood because my influences are pretty ranging, starting with jazz, really.
Yeah.
So 30 years later, I'm releasing my first jazz album this August, and it's called Ballads. So it's a nod to Billie Holiday and Coltrane, and also classic American writers from the 1930s to 60s. So there's some Americana woven in there, too, because I feel like genres are often limiting, so I'm mixing up genres and showing that side of myself. But yeah, I'm many things, and it's hard to compartmentalize. I worship at the altar of music.
Right. All right. August 11th is when the new album Ballads comes out. One more question for you, Kristen. Did you get a good grade in the class?
I did. But Paula, I think as long as she sees that you're putting in the effort, I think she's a pretty lenient grade.
Oh, yeah. To me, it's like you're not there to be amazing. You're there to learn and be humble and show up.
Being in her class made me a more honest writer, I will have to say.
You mentioned the junk food on Top 40 radio a moment ago. Paula, it would be an awkward segue here because we're flashing back 20 years ago, 1997. You were the healthy choice for a while.
I'm not making any declarations about that, but I guess I have strove to make lasting music, you know, and it was popular then, and that was an interesting journey. Yeah, like all of a sudden, my star rose very quickly, and my songs were on the radio, and that was a fantastic ride. It was also awkward for this introvert, right, to be thrust into the spotlight. So I ended up taking time away from the music business. But yeah, I was there, 1997.
Well, let's talk specifically about Where Have All the Cowboys Gone. You wrote it yourself. What was the inspiration? How did it come about? Certainly an atypical pop hit, although with that catchy chorus and so many hooks in the song, you can see why it became a hit. But how did the song come about?
Yeah, I mean, there's real craft to honing a perfect gem of a pop tune. There's ability in that I revere. And I remember the idea came to me. I was listening to a lot of XTC. Do you guys know who I'm talking about?
They're
a band out of England.
Do you two younger people remember this?
I don't think I do.
I'm trying, but XTC. Nothing's coming.
I remember,
and
Paul.
Produced by Hugh Padgham. They were a British band, like 80s, and really interesting stories and funny. Wry, you know, they they were smart and funny and telling stories. And I had this aha moment thinking, there are not a lot of songs with humor written by women for women. And I wanted to try that. And also when I ended up, so I wrote this, Where Have All the Cowboys Gone? It came spilling out onto the page from the pen. You know, it's part of the unconscious vernacular started by Pete Seeger with Where Have All the Flowers Gone. And it kind of refreshed that. And it was a look at gender roles. And it was this humorous but melancholy twist of wordplay and storytelling. Wildly misinterpreted by certain people, and that's all right, right? We're all in this together. But of course it was feminist. Of course it was ironic. And I wrote it originally with a Roomba feel, and nobody paid any attention to it because it was kind of this weird little tune. But as a couple of years rolled by, I thought, that's a good tune, and I brought it out of the closet of my song catalog and re-demoed it with like a Ringo Starr kind of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band reprise feel. I don't know if you have listened to that album, but the end of the album, Paul says, one, two, three, four, and then Ringo was playing, so I sampled Ringo's drums there and re-demoed the song over Ringo. Of course, that's not in the version now because we couldn't do that. And I added the catchy background vocals and the bridge, and then everybody went nuts for the tune.
Right.
And when I recorded it for real, I didn't want bass on it. I wanted it to sound full on its own without bass. It would have been wearing two heavy shoes with bass. And I loved the way When Doves Cry sounded by Prince without bass. And so I guess really I was influenced by XTC, Pete Seeger, Prince, and Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, it's certainly you're proving about not being put into one box.
I don't know. I'm just trying. Thanks.
Were you surprised that it was a hit? I mean, obviously it was so catchy, but you know, a lot of dance music at that time in 1997. It was just more of an adult theme, and as you said, the storytelling angle to it. What was your reaction when it started becoming such a big hit?
It was pretty amazing to be walking down a New York City street and hearing it from somebody's Walkman as I passed him, or stuck in traffic and hearing it on the radio in a car next to me. That was incredible. And when it's happening to you for the first time, it's surreal. When it happens again, you're a little more used to it. You're, I guess you're more aware of the star maker machinery and chart positioning and all of that. You're more seasoned, but the first time, it's this psychedelic acid trip. It really is. It's so weird, and your life is changing because everyone's all up in your business, and you know.
And you said you're as an introvert, wasn't all great? I guess were there some times you just wanted to hide from all the publicity you were suddenly getting?
Of course. I missed my friends and my family, and I longed for meaningful conversation instead of the same questions. And it's so repetitive. You are in this tour bubble of a van or a tour bus or a plane, and I'm with my beloveds, my band, thank God, and you're just going all over the world, and you keep playing the same songs. And I definitely tried to make it fresh for myself. We would change the set list, and sometimes I'd come out in a pink wig and sing La Vie en Rose or something, and just to make it interesting.
Right.
But it's very repetitive, and you can see why people become casualties of the music business. It's at some point, when it becomes so repetitive, you think, God, I could be making shoes or donuts. It feels a little factory-like, and you know, this very thing that you have loved, that is music, is becoming something you hate. You know? But honestly, I think that it was never the music that, the music itself, like that precious hour on stage, all the shit that you're living through, you have to love that hour on stage because you are sitting in airports and doing endless interviews for that 1 hour on stage. And that's sacred. And I loved my band. We're playing music together since we were 19. I think it was more the loss of anonymity and the, you know, the intrusion. You're, you know, in the bathroom stall in a women's room and someone's waiting outside for an autograph, that kind of thing. Or back in the day, this is pre-9/11, it might leak out what flight you're on, and they would, you know, folks would meet you right at the gate, right as you're stepping off the plane, and be haranguing you with papers for autographs from the moment you're walking off the gate to your car. Trust me, I only had a brief moment. I didn't experience the level of fame that so many do, but it was enough for me to not like it, I guess.
Did you guys talk about this in class, Kristen? Paula, I know it was specifically about voice and writing, but it sounds like this may have come up when you guys were talking to some of these overall career type angles.
We definitely talked about how, I guess, fame can sort of like mess with your mind. And I think Paula's main message throughout the class was to just stay true to yourself. So we did briefly talk about it. I think that we look at Paula as such a mentor. We forget that she's, you know, a Grammy Award winner and that
right.
She's, you know, she had huge, huge hits. And, yeah, because we just look at her as our teacher, as our mentor, as sort of a motherly figure even. And, you know, she would like hold our hands. She would give us hugs. So I think that her main point of the class was no matter what you do, whether you do decide to become a pop writer, and it sounds like sometimes she's like, I don't really like pop music, but I think she really does if you're writing it from an authentic place.
Right.
And I think that was the main point of the class. So if you do achieve fame or if you decide to go a completely different route that's not mainstream, that you just do what feels right for you.
That was the whole Lilith Fair era, Paula. Did you feel real camaraderie on tour and being with so many of those artists at that time that I suppose were having maybe in some ways unexpected hits along with yours? You know, Lisa Loeb and Sarah McLachlan suddenly having hits, so many other acts at that time.
It was a wonderful time in music looking back on it. And there were even more independent radio stations then, so the playlist was more diversified. It was a great time to be in one's 20s. I was living in New York City. I was in my 20s in the 90s in New York City, and it was explosive and wonderful. Lilith Fair was a zeitgeist born out of just some of the great music that happened to be made by female artists. And those crowds at Lilith Fair were truly awesome. It felt like maybe the original spirit of Woodstock, like peace and love, man. It was beautiful.
Right.
And every time we played, we'd donate to local women's shelters and present them with a check. And that felt amazing to be making a difference in each community as we went. Whether the artists were female or male, some of them, you know, I connected with more deeply than others. Some I didn't really connect with at all. It just, but the music was good. Music was really good then. I was happy to be part of it.
So open up your morning light and say a little prayer for I. You know that if we are to stay alive, then see the peace in every eye.
Let me ask you, Paul, about your other huge pop hit. I guess probably less surprising that it became a hit because it was more typical pop radio type hit. I Don't Want to Wait. Can you take us behind the creation of, and inspiration of that song?
I felt my grandfather was going to die, and he did. And I wrote this song. I was writing this song with him and my grandmother woven in it right before he died, and then after. So this song really was for him. So if you listen to the lyrics, you know, he's in the war of 44. He comes home with shrapnel in his skin. And it's a look at my grandfather and his relationship to my grandmother. They kind of had an unhappy marriage in their later years. And we now know that he probably had PTSD from being in World War II. So, you know, we were told not to touch Grandpa's legs or don't surprise Grandpa. But there were no diagnoses, you know, psychologically for those things then. And I was thinking about him a lot because he was leaving the planet, and I was thinking about his effect on my father and that effect on me, and how I was really hoping not to make some of those mistakes being passed down from generation to generation. And I wanted to break free from that chain, that I wanted to live an examined life before it was over, really. So I guess that was my attempt to express some of those thoughts, and they ended up coming out in a very catchy way because I do love an anthemic chorus.
And then the whole Dawson's Creek tie in the song is going to just last forever.
Oh, yeah.
In some ways, just because of that. How crazy was that?
They came and took the song. It was such a big thing. Dawson's Creek was so much bigger than me. So people tend to think of it as the theme song of Dawson's Creek as opposed to Paula Cole's song. So it became so big. And that's when I was taking a break from the music business, too, when that whole thing bloomed. And I had my daughter. I took about an 8-year hiatus from the music business to kind of reset and have Sky. And Sky had asthma, too, so I had to take care of her. I couldn't work, even though I missed it and I wanted it. I just needed time away. So when I came back, it was a really different music business. It was like pre- and post-internet.
Your new album started as a Kickstarter project, right?
That's right, and that's increasingly the reality for all kinds of musicians. And honestly, I think it's much more functional, and you have a lot more creative control over your music. I like it very much. Thank you very much. I like it very much. It's clean. It's functional. I can retain the masters and make creative decisions. So I'm happy with it. And I like my direct contact with my beautiful fan folk. Like, they're just fantastic. I don't take them for granted. Taking 8 years off from the music business is like a near-death experience in pop music, you know.
Right.
Who's going to be there on the other side? And that's when, you know, all of your taking chances, all of your desire to change. Like, I went from This Fire to Amen, and that was a big change, and a lot of people couldn't wrap their head around it, but I was influenced by social, political, spiritual writers, and I wanted to write something in that vein. Even hip-hop was, like, a lot of hip-hop was moving in that direction, and I was criticized for doing that. You know, a white female singer-songwriter rapping or being influenced and talking about spirituality or social movement, that was just, they wanted to keep me in some box, and I'm not going to be in a box. I change. And so I shed some fans, but the ones that know me from Harbinger and from, you know, they love me for the change. They are with me on the journey. So they were there for me on the other side of the hiatus. It's a smaller fan base, but I'm really free and I can do what I want. My career is interesting. It's rich and satisfying, and I can do what I want now. I'm not sitting down in a corporate atmosphere being asked when, you know, what quarter is my album going to be released in, and they're going to be disappointed if I'm not double platinum, or, and they're talking about golf more than they are music, frankly. I'm really happy with the new model that is music business, as long as you stay connected to your fan base.
Maybe one of my favorite details of your career that I actually didn't remember, but you're from Rockport, Massachusetts. I'm from just south of Boston in Braintree. If this is true on Wikipedia, you sang the national anthem at Game 6 of the NBA Finals. In 2008, the Celtics won the title over the Lakers that night. So a real good luck charm for the Celtics.
That was wonderful. Yeah.
Gary gets made fun of for being a Boston sports fan here in New York.
All the time.
I had to tout that one. All right. Paula, the new album is Ballads, August 11th. That comes out. Any favorite song on the new album? Or you just love this whole project, as you said, taking you back to your jazz roots in a lot of ways?
Well, I love Naima. That's with John Coltrane. And I love Ode to Billy Joe, which is the Bobby Gentry tune. And that'll be my next kind of teaser single coming out July 7th, Ode to Billy Joe, which, again, Bobby Gentry, man, self-produced, female. She won Best New Artist. I relate to her a lot. She was an introvert, didn't like the music business, and disappeared for a while. And she wrote this amazing song called Ode to Billy Joe. It's another story. So that'll be my next kind of teaser song. And Naima by Coltrane, those could be my favorites. And oh, and My One and Only Love. I just love that song so much.
Well, congratulations, Paula, on 20 years.
Hey, no, thank you for
success.
Your support. All right, take care, everyone.
Thanks to Paula Cole for coming here on the Billboard Sharpie podcast with Kristen, our intern, as well. And it was – I actually remember, Trevor, before Where Have All the Cowboys Gone, she had another hit, a song sort of locally in Boston. It was called I'm So Ordinary. Really insightful singer-songwriter, just a storytelling type song. It's worth checking out if you don't know it. But I knew that song ahead of time. So when Where Have All the Cowboys Gone probably became – the first hit that people knew on a large scale by Paula, you know, that song was the breakthrough for most people. I at least knew that she was talented. And I was excited to see her have such a big hit with Where Have All the Cowboys Gone?
Yeah, I mean, she was definitely, I can just tell in the interview, she was really warm. And for somebody who really, you know, wasn't fame crazy or going after it, I mean, it is awesome to see that it's still paid off for her and that her peers recognized her as well, winning that Grammy for Best New Artist of 1997. And I mean, also nominated, I think, for all the Big Four awards. So her peers really took to her very well. Obviously, the public did as well. And it's glad to see, that she's happy that it happened. It's great for her that it happened. But, you know, she's lives her life from now on. It's just, you know, hey, something I just did.
That's what Kristen was saying. She's Mama Paula to us. She's our professor. You know, some students didn't live through when the song was such a hit, but seems like she's happy to have had that moment where these songs were big, but also happy to kind of gotten out of what she was kind of talking about, the machine of touring. How she said it could have been making shoes. Kind of sad to hear that in some cases there's just so much repetition to being an artist. You think it's all glamour, but obviously, a lot of work. We know that, but sometimes it just can be a little overwhelming for certain people.
Yeah, and one thing that in particular I thought that was interesting that she noted was, you know, even though she acknowledged that her moment wasn't sort of this multi-decade expansion, like say someone like Madonna or something, even as suffocating and sort of torturous as that was for her, I mean, that's even without social media and all that sort of, you know, pressure to be on 24/7. So you can really imagine, you know, you take what she had. And you add, you know, all the sort of new technologies that you have to be actively involved in every minute of every step of the way. You're always potentially going to get recorded. It'll be out there in 2 seconds.
Right.
And now you can see sort of why you know, the Biebers and Demi Lovato and Selena Gomez and all of them had to take breaks for so long because it's just, you know, I mean, the pressure on these kids is enormous.
Right. But hey, she sounds happy. So that's the best thing about her. She sounds like she is certainly in a great place.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, not, you know, not bitter, not, you know, where are the rest of my hits? Just, you know, I mean, almost like, look, you know, looking in an optimistic way that, you know, hey, she got lucky that she even was out there and got this and it paid off. So, yeah.
Yeah, in 1997, this is just about when email was starting.
Yeah, everyone had their AOLs and their hot mails coming
through. You get those CDs that would come in the mail. You'd have AOL for however long the sample.
Like a 30-day trial something or like whatever, that. Yeah.
All right, so 20 years ago, 1997, let's continue on. We're looking at the top 40 hits on the Billboard Hot 100 this week in 1997. Let's pick up at number 20.
Everybody put your hands together.
Number 20, looking back on the Billboard Hot 100 this week, 20 years ago, Cupid by 112. They're coming up again here on the countdown.
Cupid, okay, nice.
Savage Garden, number 19, I Want You. Before they were known for their ballads, I Knew I Loved You in 2000, Truly Madly Deeply in 1998. I Want You was their first hit, up-tempo hit, got to number four, so that was their first hit.
That's a little Aussie invasion over there.
Monica, number 18, For You I Will. Space Jam.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's a great tune for Monica. Top 10 hit for Monica. Big hit for her as well from the Space Jam soundtrack. Interesting, too, because it really sort of does that thing that a lot of soundtrack singles in the 90s did. It really bridged the link between her first album, a little more on the rowdy urban side, if you want to call it that, Miss Thang, and what will be her next album coming out the next year with The Boy Is Mine. The Boy Is Mine would be on that, Angel of Mine. So definitely... you know, this time Monica's like turning 18, so she's really, you know, becoming an adult, growing into her own person, and this is a great ballad that shows her off.
Right. A year later, at this time, summer 1998, she'd be number one with The Boy Is Mine.
Yeah.
Here's a song that came back. It's so 90s that the song would be remade this way. It was Hard to Say I'm Sorry by As Yet featuring Peter Cetera. So it had been a huge hit for Chicago in the 80s, and he left the band not on the best terms back in the 80s. So in the late 90s, he was actually re-recording some Chicago songs because they wouldn't give him permission for the masters of the original ones. So he wanted to put out some of those songs again. So he re-recorded them. And because it was the 90s, it made sense to get with a vocal R&B group. So that's how you got As Yet. Featuring Peter Cetera, brought the song back to the top 10. And he'd team with them again. They then remade after this, You're the Inspiration, another Chicago hit from the 80s.
You know, shame that it had to come that way, but also, I mean, nice for As Yet, you know, sort of getting a nice little silver lining I don't think anyone could have expected in their career either.
And number 16, Smile by Scarface featuring Tupac and Johnny P. One of the deeper Tupac cuts?
I mean, I guess, yeah, I mean, it's obviously not one of Tupac's best known songs just because he's not really the main artist on it, obviously. I mean, Scarface, you know, had his moment there as well. I mean, the whole, really that whole label at the time, doing some big things. As we know, hip hop was running the charts, and it's not obviously just the Bad Boy East Coast side, but we got some love for West Coast as well.
I hear the call, it's 6 a.m. I feel so far from where I've been. I got my
aim. I won't be held responsible. She fell in love in the first place. For the life of me, I cannot remember what made us think that we were wise and we never compromised. For the life of me, I cannot believe we'd ever die for these sins. We were merely flash men. Something to me, it sends a shock right through me. I can't get enough. And if you
want, you're looking in your seat, better letters with my me. Get all you need.
Okay, we'll keep on climbing here. Up to the top 15 songs, flashing back to this week in 1997. Coming in at number 15, we have Jewel. Jewel's You Were Meant For Me. So the song had been number 2, sliding back down to number 15 this week. Again, we kind of mentioned a little bit earlier with Paula Cole, that Lilith Fair era. Jewel up there with one of the folksy singer-songwriters making her big splash at this time, too. We'll move on to number 14 this week, The Verve, Pipe with The Freshman.
Not to be confused with The Verve and Bittersweet Symphony, also a hit in that same kind of time.
Well, Verve was the word. Grease was the word in the 70s. Verve is the word in the 90s. Keep it alive. All right, moving on to 13, we got Third Eye Blind, Semi-Charmed Life, which, of course, even as the sound tech over there, Kate can attest that she's... You know, that's one of those sort of staple songs that is very 90s, very alt-centric, that everyone who was an alt fan at the time, just one of those kind of iconic songs at the time. All right, moving on to number 12. We have not heard from a country song in a while, so now is as good a time as ever to pick one up. How about Tim McGraw's It's Your Love with... Soon? Are they married at
this
point? Yeah,
no, they had just been married in late 1996.
That would be with Faith Hill, so probably maybe their first recording as husband and wife?
It was their first of... So they've had 6 charted duets. This was the first one, a huge number one country hit. All 6 of them have hit the top 10 on the country chart. And even now, 20 years later, they're actually on the chart still together with that 6th top 10 country, a duet together. Speak to a Girl was a number 6 hit back in April, still on Hot Country Songs Now.
Oh, and they also tour together. They're on their Soul to Soul tour that started back in April. So, I mean, this is a husband and wife who are, you know, it's ride or die. They're all in.
And yeah, flashing back at 20 years, the first hit. So that's kind of gives you a perspective on that. And how about this, Trevor? If no Tim McGraw, maybe... There's no Taylor Swift, at least her first hit, called Tim McGraw, which would be in 2006. But maybe a young Taylor Swift, who was 7 years old at the time, she turned 8 in late 1989, was being influenced by this very song.
Well, maybe. I mean, maybe with no Faith Hill, because, you know, Taylor always said that Faith and Shania and the women of country are inspiration. So maybe without Faith, then she would never really pay attention to Tim.
Right.
And maybe that could have, maybe it would have been called Garth Brooks instead. All right, we'll move one spot up from the Lovebirds there. Coming in at number 11, we got Changing Faces with Get O.U.T., a nice little sort of kiss-off R&B ballad of the times.
I just like the wordplay, Get O.U.T.
That, I mean, I don't know who wrote this song. Oh, my gosh.
Right?
I should have known. The 90s chameleon of songwriting himself. It's a Robert Kelly track. Robert Kelly written and produced. See, that's the thing is most people don't know. You know, R. Kelly, very, you know, prolific producer and songwriter, just not for his own records, but, I mean, the first Aaliyah album was basically all R. Kelly. You've seen some things with various artists in the 90s. I mean, obviously this song, Maxwell's Fortunate, you know, R. Kelly is
Michael Jackson's You Are Not Alone.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. How could I forget Michael Jackson? Some other, you know, huge stars out there as well. So again, another R. Kelly written and produced track right there.
And you hear the harmonies in the production in that song just a little bit before Beyonce and Destiny's Child would really start a run of hits that's now 20 years strong. But you hear that sound, those R&B girl groups of the 90s. That's the sound right there.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to bring that up too. Like, that's a huge time for, you know, the Invogues of the world, the SWVs. I mean, probably for every one that you do mention, there's probably five of those out there that you forget about. I mean, also in this time, Escape has been out for a little while. Divine coming the next year,
right.
Lately, about to be another Hot 100 number one. So, I mean, again, this fits right in that mold. Like I said, you hear the harmonies, you hear the production. It's right of its time.
All right, we're up to the top 10 this week, 1997, 20 years ago. Let's get into the top 10 with actually two pretty historic top 10s at number 10 and number 9. Into the top 10 this week, 20 years ago on the Billboard Hot 100. So at number 10 was Backstreet Boys, Quit Playing Games With My Heart. Number 9, Robin, Do You Know What It Takes? Those songs were up number 13 to number 10, and number 12 to number 9. First top 10 for the Backstreet Boys on the Hot 100, 20 years ago this week.
I mean, when that sound moves up, the Backstreet Boys are, you know, really here to stay at this point. Here they come with, obviously, the album had been out for a little while overseas, but making their U.S. splash.
So Backstreet Boys, first top 10. Robin's first top 10, Do You Know What It Takes? And both written by Max Martin. His first two top 10s on the Hot 100. Got them the same week, this week, 20 years ago. Both of those songs, 20 years later now. He has 22 number ones on the Hot 100. Third most all time after Paul McCartney, 32. And 26 for John Lennon. And he was hitting the top 10 for the first time this week, 1997.
And leave it to Max Martin, of course, to do it not once but twice in the same week. That just really shows how prolific a hitmaker he has become. And funny that he has, I mean, those two acts, people, I guess, probably would not expect those two. Backstreet Boys, probably people would guess, like, okay, sure, that probably was one of Max Martin's first hits. But, you know, Robin has taken on sort of this other end of the spectrum where sort of your pop purists and maybe people who aren't, you know, just listening to Top 40 or whatever, really appreciate Robin and get into her.
She's really appreciated now, 20 years later, on a level that maybe she wasn't even then.
Yeah, I mean, I think as people look back, especially, like, I mean, her influence, obviously, you can see going forward, and people sort of give her more credit, yeah, in retrospect, as a trailblazer. But that's just, you know, kind of crazy that Max Martin was, you know, really in a way behind getting some of that momentum out there too.
Yeah. So a historic week for Max Martin and both those acts. And 20 years later too, they're both doing really well. Backstreet Boys 2017 just got their first number one on the country chart with Florida Georgia Line.
Yeah, who would have guessed that?
And Robin, there was a remake earlier this year by Callum Scott of Dancing on My Own, a more recent Robin hit from this decade, but it, again, shows her influence, still lasting. Moving on, number eight was a debut, Sean Colvin, Sonny Came Home, right there in that same lane with Jewel. Paula Cole, another great Lilith Fair hit. Sean Colvin's been around for a long time. This was her huge pop breakthrough. She's had really good songs before and after. She's worked with so many other singer-songwriters, but this was her big pop hit, a great, great lasting hit.
Yeah, also a huge critics' favorite the next year, taking home record and song of the year at the Grammys, so another win for the singer-songwriters out there.
And how about at number seven, wasn't Wannabe by the Spice Girls, Say You'll Be There, their second hit. Now we know we're back in 1997.
Yeah, I mean, this is that. Yeah, that solidifies it for sure. I mean, obviously, you know, Spice Girls taking over. I mean, again, the influence and the celebration that they get all this time later is, I mean, it's enormous. Even right. When they, you know, they rarely reunite really now for anything, but when they do, it's always a big deal. It's kind of incredible to see how much their influence and their celebration is still felt around the world to this day. I mean, you ask anybody who's in that target age group for their audience. I mean, they, you know, I'm sure they all saw the movie and they saw right. Spice World. They had the albums. They, you know, everything was Spice Girls.
It was related. A combination of catchy music and girl power. That was it's a really good combination for a young female fan base.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really wasn't an act, you know, who really celebrated girl power like that. And I mean, the fact that they were, you know, a mixed group of different races and different hairstyles and different attitudes and everything. I mean, you know, any girl could be a Spice Girl. And I think that was very important to them. And, you know, I mean, on a marketing front, probably a huge thing.
And at number six, I Belong to You, Every Time I See Your Face by Ro.
We thuggish, ruggish niggas always, always. And ready to bring the war of you. We thuggish, ruggish niggas always, always. And ready to bring the war of you. Look into my eyes and tell me what it is.
Top five of the Hot 100 this week in 1997. We got five songs left to go, and let's kick things off with the song in fifth place this week. We got Look Into My Eyes from Batman and Robin by Bone Thugs and Harmony. Yeah, and the year before, you know, they had that smash hit across the board with the Crossroads. Huge hit, number one on the Hot 100 for 8 weeks. I mean, scores them a Grammy as well. A tribute to Eazy-E, who had passed away a few years before, not too recently, but of complications with AIDS. So really, and you know, their mentor and who they looked up to for a long time. So that tribute to come out, obviously, you know, piggybacking off the success of that, and of course, got to give a shout out to the 1997 film that it comes from, Batman and Robin. This is the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze. If you remember that, George Clooney is Batman. I mean, just what a cast of characters, you know?
And at number four, this is how you know we're flashing back so long. The song is now back in a commercial, Return of the Mac, Mark Morrison.
All right, and another song that is definitely of this era as well. If you grew up during this time, you know this song for sure. It is M-Bop by Hanson, the trio of Zach and Taylor and Isaac, taking over the chart. 1997, the song had backtracked a little bit to this week down to number three, but still, I mean, one of those infectious songs that is just, I mean, the most teeny bopper kind of fun sing-along song. They were actually in our office too as well a little while ago, and they kind of shared a cool insight about this song because everyone kind of remembers it as kind of this little bouncy sort of, I would have sung it, but I'm not going to sing anymore for Gary. But they actually wrote it as like a pretty like somber kind of tune.
And some of the lyrics, you don't always hear the lyrics. You hear just a happy, bouncy pop song. But yeah, some of the lyrics are about how relationships don't last. In an mbop, they're gone is actually what it means. But it was turned into an up-tempo song. The Dust Brothers producers turned into such a hit. And, you know, people remember this one song. The Hanson had a few other chart hits, but they seem like the nicest guys. They just love being musicians. So even if they haven't had a whole bunch of other hits since then, they still tour a lot. They have a really passionate fan base still after all these years. So that's great to see.
Yeah, and I mean, it's incredible, especially back in their home state of Oklahoma. And I mean, think about it. These guys are – it's been 20 years, but I mean, the guys are barely like in their 30s right at this point. I mean, they're still so young, even when you think that they'd be, you know, sort of ancient out there. But I mean, great to see that they're still striding on. And one thing I always like to see, and that I at least appreciate, is, you know, I know it's hard for artists when you have sort of that one song that everyone is gravitating towards and they want to hear it at concert. I mean, it's nice that they don't really shy away from that, or, you know, some artists will refuse to kind of play their song or they hate to be associated with it. You know, I mean, I think that's awesome that they embrace what made them, you know, famous.
And interesting that we had back at number 28, Bee Gees, Song Alone. At number 3, Mbop, Hanson. Two brother trios from kind of different eras, both in the top 40 at the same time this week.
Certainly different, kind of different eras. Certainly different eras.
A little mixing from the 60s onto today, right?
I mean, we're Gen X, millennialing. Okay, all right. All right, Gary, all right. moving on to number 2. This is just one of those... the great titles, you got to say. Number 2 song in 1997 this week, Bitch by Meredith Brooks.
See, I was working radio at the time. We weren't allowed to say it on the adult top 40 radio station. We could play it.
Do you have to say B, the Meredith Brooks song?
There's Meredith Brooks, or Meredith Brooks is coming. She could say it. She was the artist. But it sounded a little harsh if a DJ said the title. So, yeah, it's one of those radio rules. Trying to keep it family friendly, but didn't stop the song from becoming a number 2 hit. Great song.
Yeah, definitely one of those songs that, you know, in the post-Alanis Morissette Jagged Little Pill vein, I think a lot of the women singer-songwriters out there really definitely flexing their muscles, feeling like they can take on more, you know, aggressive topics, aggressive language, not have to censor themselves and sort of fit into this, you know, I guess either this Celine, Whitney, Mariah box at the time. I mean,
yeah, this was part of that.
This opened a lane, yeah.
Yeah, it was part of the Lilith Fair, the whole feel, even if this wasn't as folky. This is much more of an in-your-face pop alternative song. Certainly fit, and that helped to become such a big hit.
All right, and moving on from Meredith Brooks to the number 1 song of this week, July 12th, 1997. Number 1 song on the Hot 100, coming in for 5 weeks straight at number 1. We mentioned him a little bit earlier, Notorious B.I.G., not a Notorious B.I.G. song, but would not have been possible without him. Check it out. So yes, that is Puff Daddy and Faith Evans, I'll Be Missing You, also featuring 112, who we saw earlier on the chart as well. So one of the all-time great tribute songs, specifically crafted after Biggie's murder earlier in the year 1997. Puff wanted to pay tribute in some way. This is how he did it. And of course, people also remember probably that iconic VMAs performance that he did a little later in the year, also bringing out Sting from The Police, because the song, you know, heavily inspired by Every Breath You Take from 1983.
So back at number 25, we heard Puff Daddy with Can't Nobody Hold Me Down. which reworked Matthew Wilder's Break My Stride. This song, number one, reworked another 80s song, The Police, you just mentioned. Here's something I think that gets lost in terms of just chart fun facts. So the original Every Breath You Take by The Police was number one for 8 weeks in summer 1983. And then in summer 1997, I'll Be Missing You, it really takes so much of that song, was number one for 11 weeks. In some ways, you could make the argument that Every Breath You Take and slash I'll Be Missing You, with a total of 19 weeks at number one, 8 for the original, 11 for this version, sort of the longest reigning number one song of all time. We know the record is Mariah and Boyz II Men with One Sweet Day for 16. But if you take these two songs together, because it's built on the same melody, 19 weeks at number one for both of those together.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's also a credit to Puff Daddy. I know people sometimes rip on him because, you know, he samples too much, or he just kind of, you know, he's not original and like that. But it's, you know, there's talent in being able to take so many songs that so many people know and, you know, adding a spin, a twist. I mean, even be able to rap over it just in general. So, I mean, you can't be a novice producer and make it work.
And I'm sorry, you know that time moves forward. These two Puff Daddy songs, we're talking about sampled 80s hits. And now it's common we see songs sampled from the 90s. You know, Camila Cabello's a new song samples Genie in a Bottle,
which is barely a 90s song in itself.
I was going to say, it's actually 2 years after what we're flashing back to, 97. That was a hit in 1999. So samples continue. It just now they've moved forward a decade or so. And that means, if you think about it, that songs that are out now, maybe 10, 15, 20 years from now, are going to come back sampled in future hits by people that maybe haven't even been born yet.
Yeah, I mean, you wonder what, you know, is someone going to sample? I mean, I guess when you think of certain songs, like what could be sampled, like I would not be surprised if somebody sampled sort of the robotic background of Single Ladies. Like, I feel like that little, like the whatever beat it's built off that The Dream and Tricky Stewart made, like that feels like something that people would really grab onto.
Oh, two recent hits that sample stuff even more recent. Ed Sheeran, at least through writing credits, Ed Sheeran and No Scrubs from 1999, Shape of You.
And having to sneak, you know, Tiny and Shakespeare and Candy on there to get their checks.
And here's a 2000s one, Chainsmokers Closer. Wound up by giving credit to The Fray for Over My Head. That's from 2006. So here we go. In 2017, we do have a song that samples a 2006 hit.
I guess some people kind of wonder, are we going to, like, is the machine going to catch up too fast? Are we sampling things from last year, this year? And...
All right. So there it is. 1997, flashing back 20 years this week. And number one, Puff Daddy, Faith Evans, featuring 112, I'll Be Missing You. So next week, I don't know if I should say we're going to go forward or we're going to go back to 2007.
We'll just arrive there, however we get there.
All right. Next week, we'll count down the top 40 on the Hot 100 in mid-July 2007 on the Billboard Chartbeat podcast. And our guest is going to be Joe Riccatelli, who heads up promotion at RCA Records. At the time, he was promoting a song that Pink had at the time, You and Your Hand. And he's going to give us a whole story about that, how Pink had kind of hit a little low in her career. And that song, after a pretty long ride, a lot of promotion, it took a lot of work for the song to hit number one on the pop songs chart. And her career has been in overdrive ever since.
So, yeah, we'll pick up with the Pink Renaissance of 2007. We're also going to talk to Joe about some other high-profile acts on RCA. So we'll talk about some 90s superstars and what they're up to today in Justin Timberlake and Britney Spears. And we'll also flash forward to some recent acts as well, see what's happening with Zayn, and maybe even get some news on Kesha. So right. Be sure to tune in for that.
I think we should close, Trevor, with the song that was at number 41, just outside the top 40 this week in 1997.
What a choice, Gary. Let him know.
ESPN presents the Jock Jam. In case we weren't 1997 enough, through the entire top 40, here's one more.
Gentlemen, let's get ready to rumble!
This. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.